From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The rock and roll band Kiss has left its mark on pretty much everything that can bear a four-letter logo, including an Arena Football League team. Ahead on Only a Game, Kiss's Paul Stanley discusses the LA Kiss. Also, how the Chuck Taylor brand has endured for eight decades, a visit with the lovable 100-time losing horse Zippy Chippy, and former NFL Pro Bowler Terrell Owens takes to the lanes hoping to become a Pro Bowler. Also ahead, tennis great Jimmy Connors talks about his life on and off the court.
The fans and myself, we connected in a way that was an incredible feeling. They came in and won me more matches than probably I should have. You know, I owed them a lot, that's for sure.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The biggest news coming out of the Arena Football League last year was Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley of the rock band Kiss bringing an expansion team to Los Angeles, aptly named the LA Kiss. Paul Stanley joined Only a Game's Karen Given after he purchased the team, and she asked him why he wanted to own an AFL franchise.
Why not? That would be the simple answer, but I reflect on my career and what I've done over the last 40 years, and who would have thought that something that I dreamed and we all dreamed as kids would turn into something so much more than a rock band? It really has turned into a lifestyle and a way of life. But people should get their money's worth, you know, bang for buck, I've always believed. And having come from audiences where certainly I was one of the dissatisfied people who would see a band on stage and go, you know, they think they're doing me a favor and I paid for a ticket. So here we are in Los Angeles without a football team. Anaheim is the second largest media market outlet. And the Honda Center is a place that we've played. We know it well. So why not? AFL is something that's unique even within football. It's interesting that some people seem to think of it as the second stringers, but a diamond is a diamond. When you're talking about the upper 1% of, you know, available players, that's not too shabby. So these guys are incredible athletes, and I don't think of it as arena football. I think of it as adrenaline football.
Southern California fans are generally only interested in rooting for the very best. Will the LA Kiss deliver?
Absolutely. You know, I don't speak as loudly as perhaps my partner, but I make sure that everything I speak about comes to pass. The team is going to be fabulous. We're also going to involve entertainment. There's so many periods during the game. There's so many times where there could be something going on other than somebody dressed as a hamster running around.
Well, will the team itself be different from others in the Arena Football League? I mean, you're not going to require the players to wear makeup or anything, right?
Well, you know, I'm also not going to require them to carry a guitar. You know, this is football. It's not Cirque du Soleil and it's not a rock and roll band, but it certainly is incorporating some of the mentality that has made Kiss really a juggernaut, and we will make sure that on all fronts, whether it's the players, the cheerleaders, or the entertainment, that it's really something that you want to go to again and again.
In 2004, Jon Bon Jovi founded the Philadelphia Soul, which went on to win the 2008 AFL championship. But the Soul and the rest of the league temporarily suspended operations in 2009, and Jon Bon Jovi didn't come back for an encore. Is Kiss planning to make a longer run of it?
Well, we usually play a very long set. There were problems within the AFL in terms of the financial structure of it, and all that has been straightened out. So we'll be stronger than ever, and we will be the proof.
You and Gene Simmons look like you're still in pretty good shape. Any chance the two of you will make it onto the field?
You know, it's a fool who doesn't know his limitation. You know, as a kid, I remember thinking I was very strong, and I loved fooling around and wrestling with my friends until I got beaten and somebody busted my arm. And then it wasn't so much fun. And I remember playing football as a kid and really enjoying it until I went sailing through the air and landed on my stomach and knocked the wind out of me. And I went, you know, this isn't for me. So I will stay where I belong. But that being said, I will be accessible. You know, I mean, going to a game, it's great to have a great corporate suite to go to, but I prefer being down with everybody. I mean, who doesn't want to be close up and see things up close? So if you see me there, come say hi.
Paul Stanley is a founding member of KISS and the new co-owner of the Arena Football League's LA KISS. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
The man behind the best-selling basketball sneakers of all time is in the Basketball Hall of Fame and has remained a household name well beyond his playing days. And no, it's not Michael Jordan. We're talking about Chuck Taylor. Doug Trabu has our story.
Millions of people around the world wear Chuck Taylor's name on their ankles every day. His signature has appeared on the high-top canvas All-Star sneakers since 1932. In Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, there is a steady stream of college students, tourists, hipsters, and Chuck Taylors. Morgan Goldstein is sporting a multicolored pair of high tops. She's 23 years old and has owned several pairs of All-Stars.
They're comfortable. They're classic. My parents wore them. My mom thinks it's weird that I'm still wearing them because that's what she wore when she was a kid.
29-year-old Aleem Ahmed is wearing black low tops. Ahmed has no problem explaining why he likes the sneakers, but like most Chuck's owners, he's less certain about Taylor's story.
No, I only know him from the sneakers. Maybe he has a skateboarding background? I don't know.
Abraham Amador wrote a biography of Taylor published in 2006 titled Chuck Taylor All-Star.
It became like Betty Crocker in a sense. If you were a cook, you knew the name Betty Crocker. There was no such person as Betty Crocker, but there really was such a person as Chuck Taylor. Most Americans didn't know that. People who were buying his shoes by the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond, they just thought of Chuck Taylor as a brand. His brand grew with the shoe, even as his persona, the real persona, was lost.
Charles Taylor was born in 1901, just 10 years after Dr. James Naismith is credited with inventing the game of basketball. Taylor grew up in Columbus, Indiana, and played for the Columbus High Bulldogs. He graduated in 1919 and eventually landed in Akron, Ohio, where he played for the Firestone Non-Skids, a semi-pro team owned by the tire manufacturer. But in 1922, he accepted a job as a salesman at Converse, and basketball was a critical part of his position.
He loved the game. He loved being a part of it. He put on clinics all over the country, helping kids learn how to play a little bit better.
Joe Dean worked for Converse for nearly 30 years, ending his tenure as a vice president. When Dean was hired in 1959, Taylor was already a giant at the company and in the world of basketball.
He was a lovable guy and fun to be around and a nice guy. And he at one point knew every best college basketball coach in the country. And if you wanted to hire a coach, you went through him. He'd recommend somebody.
In the 1920s and 30s, Taylor played on Converse's own team and generated publicity in local newspapers with countless basketball clinics. The self-promotion paid off. The All-Star had debuted in 1917, but 15 years later, Converse added Taylor's name. Amador says customers had already made the switch.
People would order Chuck's shoe or Chuck Taylor's shoe instead of the Converse All-Star. So his signature was added just underneath the five-point star. Brilliant marketing, brilliant branding.
Taylor never asked for a royalty for having his name on the shoe. Air Jordans have earned Michael Jordan far more money than he ever made as a player, but Converse gave Taylor a full expense account and a commission. By the time he retired in the mid-1960s, Taylor had been out on the road selling for more than 40 years. He married and divorced, then married again later in life, but had no children. Dean says Taylor had no regrets.
He went years without having a house or an apartment or anything. He lived out of a hotel 365 days a year. And that was happy for him. That Christmas Day was just another day to him. Converse paid for Christmas, just like any other. They were just glad he didn't ask for a little extra change for his name.
Today, the All-Star's waffle sole and white and black rubber sidewall are instantly recognizable pop culture images, but they were once cutting-edge features that helped Converse maintain control of the basketball sneaker market for the better part of five decades.
I like to say the Chuck Taylor All-Star was born on the basketball courts, raised by rock and roll, and really adopted by street culture and fashion over the years.
Magnus Wedhammer is the vice president of Converse All-Star. In his office in North Andover, Massachusetts, there's a row of new Chucks in a wild assortment of colors and patterns. Wedhammer is originally from Sweden, and his connection to Chuck Taylors began long before his days in the footwear business.
My first pair of Chuck Taylors was actually given to me. I was playing basketball back in Sweden, and my team was sponsored by Converse back in the late 80s and early 90s. So that's a pretty fond memory I have of the Converse brand, and I actually played in the Chuck Taylor early on and then later in the Weapon, which is another iconic model.
Wedhammer says after outliving their basketball usefulness, the sneakers became a statement for customers who are passionate about their Chucks.
Not only passionate, but it's a really personal relationship, and it evokes a lot of emotion. And from young to old, really have their own, always their own personal story and their personal love affair with the Chuck Taylor All-Star today.
Nike acquired the Converse brand in 2003 and sold 2 million pairs of All-Stars the next year. By 2011, that figure was up to 70 million pairs worldwide. That's more than 191,000 pairs of All-Stars sold every day. The classic black high top and white high top remain the best sellers. That kind of success seemed impossible in 1969 when Converse pulled Taylor out of retirement to visit his old friend and fellow Indiana native, John Wooden. Again, Abraham Amador.
They knew that UCLA and John Wooden was thinking of abandoning the shoe. As the most famous coach in basketball at that time, if John Wooden abandons the Converse Chuck Taylor All-Star, if it's no longer good enough for him, it's not going to be good enough for anybody else.
Despite the visit, Wooden's Bruins, like many other teams, switched to Adidas leather sneakers in the fall of 1969. But in the same year, Taylor also enjoyed a moment of glory. He was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts, as a contributor to the sport. He died before year's end. Taylor's groundwork prepared the All-Stars for their iconic second act as a fashion item, but to Amador, his self-made man story represents something larger.
You know, he's an American character. In the sense that we talk about people reinventing themselves. You can't say what he did. He didn't win a Nobel Prize. He's not a great mathematician. You know, he's not Johann Sebastian Bach. But his brilliance was in being an American and just an entrepreneur, and it's great.
It's impossible to know what Taylor would think of the phenomenon his Chucks have become, but any salesman would like to be on a first-name basis with the world. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
To see pictures of seriously vintage Chucks, the sneakers, and their namesake, please visit onlyagame.org. Ahead on Only a Game, competitive stone skipping in the upper Midwest. But first, with their pick in the 34th round of the 2013 Major League Baseball draft, the Arizona Diamondbacks chose Corey Hahn, an outfielder who'd last played on February 20th, 2011. On that day, in his third game for Arizona State, Hahn slid headfirst into second base, collided with the knee of the player covering the bag, and broke his neck. He's been paralyzed from the chest down since then. I spoke with Hahn shortly after he was selected, and I asked him what being chosen in the draft meant to him.
It obviously means a whole lot to me and my family, just because my whole life I've been gearing towards, you know, being a professional baseball player, and to have that dream kind of cut short was, you know, obviously a tough thing to go through, but the fact that the Diamondbacks still, you know, they still saw me as a baseball player and, you know, wanted to do this for me, it's something that my family and I will be forever thankful for.
Shortly after you were injured, your dad, Dale, resigned from his job to become your primary support system. Tell me a little bit about what that decision has meant to you.
I mean, to be honest, I wouldn't be where I am today without my dad. To be able to put his whole life on hold to help me get through my daily stuff in life and assist me with whatever I need possible. It's something that, I mean, I love him to death already, but I mean, it's something that I have the utmost respect for him, and it's something that, you know, if you ever ask him, he always would say every dad would do this for their kid, but he's actually doing it.
In Bill Plaschke's L.A. Times story about you and your father, you're quoted as saying, "We're a team and we live for small victories." Tell us a little bit about some of the recent small victories, Corey.
The recent small victories, I wouldn't call this one necessarily small, but being able to drive again is probably the big victory that's been going on. I've been able to get behind the wheel again and gain some of that independence and being able to drive and go places where I want to, when I need to, and not having to rely on people is big, and So that's kind of the new big thing that I've been able to accomplish recently. So the little things have been, you know, things like getting around campus on my own and being able to go from class to class.
Corey, since Derek Hall, the president of the Diamondbacks, has talked about employing you, I wonder if you've begun to think about what you might do on behalf of the team. I don't know what your major is as you're pursuing that degree, but what's your thinking along that line?
Yeah, well, I'm majoring at ASU. I'm majoring in business, so I'm becoming a well-rounded, hopefully well-rounded businessman with what I'm learning from there. I mean, I've put a little bit of thought into it, and I've talked to Derek a couple times, but I'm thinking, either in the front office type thing, whether it's, there's so many branches in the front office, but hopefully in the management stuff and or scouting. Either, those options are always available, and I think either way, my knowledge of the game of baseball or the stuff I'm studying in school can really pay off and be able to help the Diamondback organization.
Corey, good luck, and thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Corey Hahn graduated from Arizona State with a business degree. Arizona Diamondbacks president and CEO Derek Hall made good on his promise and hired Corey as an assistant with the team's Scout Ahead development program. Over the past 20 years, Only a Game has given many racehorses their day in the sun. I've waxed poetic about Cigar, sang the praises of Secretariat, remembered the heroics of Affirmed, and even looked into the paranormal potential of Lisa's Booby Trap. But one horse got more attention than he deserved, or at least more attention than he earned.
There's just something about that name, Zippy Chippy.
That's Bill Flynn, then a reporter for member station WXXI in Rochester, New York. He was on the scene in 1999 for Zippy Chippy's record-setting 86th consecutive race without a win.
He jumped right out. He was amongst the contenders, and through most of the race, he was there. He fell from the leaders in the last quarter mile of the race and finished about 13 and a quarter lengths back.
That same week, Only a Game sent a reporter out to meet Zippy, which wasn't an easy feat. Once the reluctant racehorse started running, it was actually difficult to get him to stop.
Oh, Zippy. Oh.
That's Zippy's trainer, Felix Monserrati.
And long he want to keep running, I'm going to run him. Even if he runs slow. I think he feels sad when he don't do something. That's why I keep training him.
A year later, Zippy was still running, and he was still slow. In 2000, during my weekly Zippy Chippy update with Only a Game analyst Charlie Pierce, I noted that the little gelding, who couldn't and never has and no doubt never will, ran his record losing streak to 87 when he finished second at a county fair right here in Massachusetts. Charlie Pierce is not known for going easy on athletes, and Zippy was no exception.
I think the phrase never has and likely never will is sort of implied in the word gelding, isn't it, first of all?
Zippy ended his racing career with a record of 100 races and 0 wins. In the summer of 2013, on the occasion of Only a Game's 20th anniversary, I went in search of Zippy Chippy to offer our apologies and perhaps a carrot. I found him in Greenfield, New York. Zippy Chippy runs no more, unless he wants to, say when he's at the far end of the corral and somebody shows up at the gate with something good to eat. That somebody is likely to be Joanne Pepper, Zippy Chippy's landlord and his most enthusiastic fan.
He is quite famous. He has quite a lot of fans, and actually every day he's getting new fans when they hear his story. People just think he's adorable.
Zippy Chippy's story is, of course, that he ran in 100 races without winning one. Well, actually, according to Joanne Pepper, he ran in 97, tops.
He stopped leaving the starting gate when it opened at Finger Lakes 3 times in a row, and then you get kicked off the grounds.
So he was kind of the Ferdinand the Bull of thoroughbred horse racing. He would rather smell the flowers than participate in the competition.
I think so, yes. Or he just enjoyed, being gracious and letting everybody else go ahead.
Zippy Chippy did manage to finish second 8 times. He got a few thirds. His career winnings totaled $30,000. It's a record that makes one wonder why his owner kept bringing Zippy Chippy to the track. Joanne Pepper thinks part of the reason was that Zippy came cheap.
He was owned primarily by Felix Monserrati, who got Zippy in a trade for a pickup truck and raced him throughout his entire career.
How many times did he find himself thinking, I should have held on to the pickup truck?
Oh, I don't know, 100 maybe. But I think most trainers would think, I don't think this horse really wants to race. And Felix thought Zippy enjoyed losing, so he kept letting him lose.
Zippy Chippy's current home is at a farm called Old Friends at Cabin Creek, a quick run from the track in Saratoga Springs. Well, quick for any horse but Zippy. Anyway, Old Friends, which is supported by donations, a few grants, and fundraisers, some featuring Zippy, is home to 14 retired racehorses, though capacity is supposed to be 12. According to Joanne Pepper, Zippy Chippy is among those okay with sharing space with a pal.
His name is Red Down South, and he's 12. The minute they got together, they became best friends, and they have not been separated since. So he's lucky. That's really the truest horse relationship that I've ever seen. Zippy loves Red and respects him, and Red looks out for Zippy. It's beautiful.
It was raining on the August day when I visited Old Friends at Cabin Creek. The farm was beautiful anyway. It was chilly, too, but the horses didn't seem to mind. I found myself wondering out loud in the presence of Joanne Pepper whether Zippy Chippy, reluctant racehorse, laughingstock, butt of the jokes of a thousand railbirds, had at last found the perfect home.
He has. I think Zippy's as happy as he can be. He looks great. He's 22 years old. He's healthy. He gets a lot of carrots, so he's well-fed, and I think he's happy.
If you want to see Zippy Chippy or any of his more accomplished neighbors at Old Friends, summer visiting hours are 11 to 4, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
And be on the radio?
Call ahead and bring carrots. To see photos of Zippy Chippy sticking his tongue out at me in retirement, please trot, don't gallop over to onlyagame.org. Fireworks, parades, barbecues, even hot dog eating contests, they've all become 4th of July staples, and ever since 1969, the Mackinac Island Stone Skipping and Gerplunking Club in Michigan has boasted an Independence Day tradition of its own, the annual professional stone skipping tournament. I spoke with Eric the Voice Steiner, the competition's play-by-play announcer, before the 2013 event, and I asked him to give a quick overview for listeners unfamiliar with a stone skipping competition.
Sure. Mackinac Island is known amongst the stone skippers across the country as the Stanley Cup of stone skipping. They all want to win this tournament. We've got stone skippers that come from Las Vegas, California, the Guinness Book record holder from Franklin, Pennsylvania. We've got former Guinness Book record holders that try and take that title back.
Is this just because there are a lot more flat stones around Mackinac Island than any place else?
Well, according to the pros, for many years, they thought that this was the flattest stone they could have. Well, what happened was, over the past couple of years, the Guinness Book record holder brought his own stones to the island. Well, there was some controversy over this, and many other of the professionals started to say, wait a minute, if he's going to bring his own stones, we want to bring stones on. So what he did is he would bring a large duffel bag of stones to the island and let them pick the stones first, and then he would pick what's left over, and he would still beat them.
All right, now we have to back up just a minute, because you've used the word professional. How much money is involved in this extraordinary sport?
Well, like I always tell the kids on the beach, you know, they're probably going to want to quit college and become a professional stone skipping, because the money is outstanding. I think this year the professional got $98.
Probably enough to pay the extra baggage for bringing stones.
Yeah, I don't even know if it carried his ferry service fee to get from the mainland to the island.
Al Michaels has declared that hockey is the hardest sport to call, but I don't know if he's ever tried to announce a stone skipping competition. What are the particular challenges that you face?
You know, you've got to be able to be on your toes, ready to go, because when that stone gets cast out over the Straits of Mackinac, you've got a lot of pity-pats is what we call them at the end. So you've got to be able to be ready. You got to have your goggles on, being able to see those pity-pats and help count and listen for the judges to be able to tell me exactly what how many stones were cast. The gentleman that won this year was Max Batman Steiner, and he had 29 skips this
year. Whoa, hold on. The guy who won has the same name as the play-by-play announcer? I smell a rat.
Well, it just happens to be my son, and he has never won this tournament in all the years he's been here. Last year, he came in at third. with 24, and this year the water just happened to be perfect when he went up to skip, and he just happened to hit it at the right spot, and that thing went out, and some of the judges even told us it went further than 29, but 29 was the official count.
And that was enough.
That took the title.
All right, I just have one more question for you, Eric. The name of the club is the Mackinac Island Stone Skipping and Gerplunking Club. What the heck is gerplunking?
Gerplunking is about how the sound of a stone hits the water, and then we judge the sound of the stone.
Ah, I see. Although a stone that went gerplunk sounds as if maybe it wouldn't skip.
Exactly. See, you should come here and do color with me. I think I'm going to offer to you next year, July 4th, I want you on the island because you're the first one that's picked up on that, to where come do color commentary with me.
I think it sounds like a fine idea. You remind me of that come mid-June next year, okay?
I will send you an email and definitely have you come on the island.
Eric Steiner is the voice of the Mackinac Island Stone Skipping and Gerplunking Club Championships. Eric, I really appreciate this. Thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
I didn't make it this year for July 4th, but maybe I'll skip on over to Mackinac Island in 2015. I'd be a rock star of sorts. According to an internationalbusinessnews.com review that all but drooled, the wax image of Cristiano Ronaldo that was unveiled in Madrid in December 2013 resembles quite a lot the Real Madrid star. Funny, to me the photo of the craven image accompanying the review looks more like Christopher Reeve when he was dressed up as Superman than it does Ronaldo. The faux Ronaldo will startle people at the Museo de Cera in Madrid. Wax images of him have been on display in London and Berlin for some time. Folks there are probably used to them. Perhaps one day all the wax works will be gathered together in a plaza to admire each other. Wouldn't it be great if that happened on an especially hot day? It's as easy to make fun of Cristiano Ronaldo as it is to make fun of Alex Rodriguez, whose home is said to feature two large depictions of the beleaguered Yankee star as a centaur, not, I suppose, because injecting steroids might ultimately equip one's lower half with a tail and hooves, but because, well, who knows why. Many decades ago, in the days when people read newspapers to find out about sports, Stanley Woodward of the New York Herald Tribune warned his reporters not to god up the athletes. If he were still around, I wonder if Mr. Woodward would warn the athletes not to god up themselves. And I wonder if it would make any difference to a man inclined to build a museum to himself, as Ronaldo has recently done, or a fellow who apparently commissioned images of himself not as a man, but as a mythical beast. Rodriguez and Ronaldo did not spring full-grown from the head of Zeus, much as either or both might be inclined to argue otherwise. They recognized their gifts and worked hard to develop their skills. Good for them. One of them has been a superb athlete, and the other one still is. Each has had the great good fortune to live at a time and in a place where his talents have been highly regarded and lavishly compensated, and somewhere along the line, the cultures over which they loom have determined that what they do and the images they create while doing it or doing something else makes them worthy of attention. So it's not all their fault, but somewhere shy of the line where one begins thinking of building a museum to oneself, some of it is, right?
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack. And the Music Emporium, for 45 years, offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Jimmy Connors talks about his life and times on and off the tennis court. But first, Terrell Owens is a six-time Pro Bowl wide receiver. In his 15 seasons with NFL teams, he racked up nearly 16,000 receiving yards. But in the fall of 2013, he started over in a new sport, and that sport was bowling. Owens joined me to discuss his new passion, and I asked him why he chose bowling after all those years in the NFL.
I was in San Francisco my first couple of years. We had an event, and Norm Duke was there. I asked Norm what the basics were, and I just started bowling. That's kind of how it started. I went and got me a ball made up, drilled, and got me some shoes, and I was kind of on my way, just kind of like bowling.
You liked it from the start. It's a wonderful idea that a guy who grows up to be a star in the National Football League, some of his idols are bowlers.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they were idols at that time, but they are my idols now.
You know, you were the owner of the PBA League's Dallas Strikers. Was it the fun aspect of it that led you to want to be a competitor as well as an owner?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to be there at the competitions, a lot of people have no idea how intense it is. Just to see some of those guys get fired up, you can tell, like, the energy is in the building. I mean, these guys are awesome. And just to be here at this tournament, dude, it's like, these guys are so good, and it's a reason why they're good, because anybody that feels like they can just go to a bowling alley or just because they bowl 240 or whatever in a league, it is totally different. It's night and day. I mean, these are future Hall of Famers that I'm playing with and rolling on the same lanes as these Hall of Famers. It was equivalent to me going from college to the San Francisco 49ers, being in the same locker room with Hall of Famers. Like Steve Young, you know, Jerry Rice, William Floyd. I mean, playing with a Hall of Fame coach like George Seifert. That's how I see the environment that I'm in now. And I couldn't be more thrilled with the idea of what may become of this.
When you're having a bad game, do you ever say, boy, I wouldn't mind just knocking that guy next to me down?
Oh, man, it's funny. The guy that was in our pair, obviously he's better than I am, but there were moments where I saw he was struggling to find the pocket, as a lot of the guys were. And so he was getting frustrated, and we had a little talk yesterday, and he was like, I can't find the pocket. And so I got to the point where I kind of found myself, you know, telling him where to throw the ball, what arrows to kind of release the ball in. And he was like, dude, he's like, I just can't find it right now. He's like, can I just line up? And you just hit me. you just come tackle me. Yeah, and I was like, yeah, I don't think that'll go so well right now. But I know it's all tongue in cheek. But yeah, I'm so thankful and blessed to be a part of it. And again, I'm gonna get better with it. Trust me. I told the guys, I'm like, this is a start for me. I feel like I got better. These guys saw that I was improving. It's just amazing.
Terrell Owens is a six-time NFL Pro Bowl wide receiver and now a professional PBA bowler as well. Thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been fun.
All right, thank you.
The PBA reports that Terrell Owens has been busy recently with non-bowling projects, but he's still working on his game and expects to be part of the PBA in the coming season. Michigan versus Ohio State, Montagues versus Capulets, Dodgers versus Giants, Cats versus Dogs, Carolina versus Duke, Darkness versus Light. The list of perennial arch rivals goes on and on. But in the summer of 2013, Karen Given ventured to Montpelier, Vermont to witness a rivalry so bitter and all-consuming that it's a wonder she returned to tell the tale.
It's 15 minutes before game time, and I'm in the appointed place, the vast and serene campus green at Vermont College of Fine Arts. But there are no bats, no balls, no bases, and no players for VCFA's annual Writers versus Poets softball game. Suddenly, Victoria Reyes storms onto the scene.
First of all, I'm a poet.
Okay. Reyes is in his fourth semester at VCFA. Like the rest of the writing program's 124 students, he's only on campus twice a year for two 10-day residencies. He graduates this winter, so this is his last chance to lead the poets to victory.
There's two things. One, the United States invests way too much money in sports and too much emotion, okay? That's the first thing. The second thing, this game is life or death. That's all you need to know.
Okay. Some say this is the 30th annual softball game pitting prose writers against poets. Others suggest it's the 32nd. Everyone knows that the poets won for 15 years in a row, unless it was 18 years in a row. No one seems to know the overall record. Louise Crowley, director of the MFA in Writing Program, says the game itself is similarly imprecise.
We might have 50 people in the outfield. It's just, you know, kind of a real informal, crazy game.
Eventually, will there be bases?
There will be bases, yes. There will be bases, there will be a batter, there will be a catcher, you know. But other than that, it's just kind of a free-flowing, everything goes.
Well, almost everything goes.
We kind of can't let it go on for 15 innings.
The game has to be over in time for dinner. After dinner, there's a reading and then hours of painstaking writing and rewriting before workshops begin again early tomorrow morning.
I don't think anybody's ever been willing to let it end at a tie, though. Maybe somebody reads a poem and a piece of prose and they decide which is better. I don't know. You may hear some poetry reading out here in the midst of the game.
Outfield. Yeah. Outfield, 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 outfield.
So we got four outfielders. Good. Perfect.
Okay.
Dude, we had like 18.
Yeah.
Last time. Yeah, and yeah, it was yeah. The ball still fell.
Faculty members are encouraged to play. Previously on the roster, at least one Pulitzer Prize winner and the Poet Laureate of Vermont. But poetry instructor Matthew Dickman has a pre-existing injury this time around, so his job is to provide inspiration of the negative variety.
Whenever a fiction writer gets up to bat, a student, I'm going to sit behind them and talk about how difficult it is to get published, how they'll probably just go back to a life of working wherever they work and their dreams will come to an end. And I'm also going to tell them I'm not joking around, I kind of hate you, you know.
That is certainly more dramatic than Hey Batter Batter.
And maybe not poetic, but, you know, it works.
The writers are taking a more positive approach.
Oh, the pros. Pros always wins. Always. The poets, they're just a bunch of illiterists.
Connie Mae Fowler is a novelist, essayist, screenwriter, and faculty member, but she is not a softball player. Though the prose writers have fallen behind early, Fowler stands at the sidelines, assured her team has the tenacity to pull out a victory.
We sit for hours and hours and hours to produce one page, and they, you know, just sit around and write a couple of lines and call it a poem. Come on, Soph! Ah!
Most of the pitches only make it about two-thirds of the way to home plate. And home plate isn't so much a plate, it's the catcher's chest protector laying on the ground where home plate should be. Every once in a while, the pitcher lobs in a good one, and the batter manages a hit, usually a pop fly that hangs over the outfield. And although the number of outfielders has ballooned to at least a dozen, every single one of those pop flies drops to the grass. By the top of the second inning, a total of 18 runs has been scored. The game began under sunny skies, but just 30 minutes later, storm clouds have gathered. The players are undeterred by showers, but it's lightning that finally forces the teams from the field in the fourth, with the Poets ahead 12-6. It's their first victory in years. No one is happier than co-captain Victoria Reyes.
Here's the thing. Since last year, we've been training nonstop for this game. Or talking about training, or
writing poetry about training?
Right. Actually, we didn't train at all. But the point is, my life is fulfilled.
Your entire life?
Exactly. That's it. I'm happy.
Reyes might be happy, but I'm not. The game has ended with nary a soliloquy. No one has hurled a haiku or lobbed a limerick.
Well, I think in honor of this victory, I will recite Dream Deferred by Langston Hughes. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun?
And as the writers and the poets and the dozens of bystanders run quickly for cover, Victoria Reyes braves the rain to make sure at least one of my dreams comes true.
Maybe it sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Poets!
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
To view Karen Given's anything but prosaic photos of poets and prose artists squaring off on a makeshift Vermont diamond, please visit facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. Only a Game NPR is also our Twitter handle. Jimmy Connors, number one in men's tennis through much of the mid and late 70s, won a total of 8 Grand Slam singles titles. In 1998, he was inducted into the Tennis Hall of Fame. Last year, he joined me to talk about his book, The Outsider, A Memoir, and I asked him if it was his mother who planted the idea that he could become good enough to beat the best.
Yeah, she gave me everything, and she gave me the game, and she gave me, you know, the attitude at the beginning that, you know, you have to go out and work hard and put everything you have into it, that really that takes just as much effort to be number one as it does to be number 100. So, you know, when you put in the time, you put it in and you work hard.
Your success and your ability to entertain the fans notwithstanding, at several points in The Outsider, you write, and I'm quoting now, "It seemed as though almost the entire tennis world was against me." Why did it feel that way? Why was that?
Well, there's a lot of things that happened early on in my career. I think, number one, that, you know, my mom was, you know, handled me and gave me tennis. And it was okay for a father to do that to their son, but not really for a mom at the time. I was kept out of the French, so there was some lawsuits and there was some animosity towards federations and so forth that, you know, that I was used kind of as a pawn in. So plus my style and my attitude was a little bit different than a lot of the old guard that had come up and gotten tennis to where it had become. You know, the Lavers, Rosewall, Roy Emerson, Arthur Ashe, Stan Smith, you know, a lot of those guys were from a different era and a different attitude. So I think that had a little bit to play in it, too.
You describe an arresting scene from the Queen's Club tournament in London in 1972 when you were nearly penalized basically for bouncing the ball too many times before you tossed it up to serve it. Tell us a little bit about why that was happening.
Well, it was my first trip to London, and going and playing in the Queen's Club and getting ready to play Wimbledon for my first Wimbledon was very exciting. But I kind of got in a routine. I guess I don't know if it was the stress or the anxiety or the excitement or whatever that, you know, just could not stop bouncing the ball. And I didn't know at the time. I found out since then that, you know, I have what's called OCD, which is obsessive compulsive. But looking back, it seems that with a lot of things that I did and the way I handled a lot of things, having to go the same route or take the same elevator or, you know, walk the same steps or whatever, the same route to a restaurant, you know, I look back and it was a little bit more than I ever expected.
I was intrigued by your discussion of two particular matches in 1974, both against Ken Rosewall, during which, and I'm quoting again here, you say, "I reached perfection, something that never happened again in the rest of my career." What was that like?
You know, to go out and to play the finals of Wimbledon, you look at it as saying, I'm in the finals. I certainly have to take advantage of this, and because I may never have this opportunity again. To strike the ball like that into on that stage and against such a great player like Ken Rosewall, not only at Wimbledon, but almost three months later at the U.S. Open in the final there again, it was a dream year. There's no doubt about it. But in reality, that's what I was striving for every time I walked out there. I reached it, but I was trying even harder after that. You know, why can't that come again? Where is that? You know, it's in there somewhere. You know, it was just unfindable. So then you have to figure out ways to win more than just having, you know, the 100 or 110% perfection every time. So that was a new experience.
It's interesting that those two matches that you characterized as perfect were against Ken Rosewall because, boy, if there ever was a player who represented the old guard in terms of his demeanor and his manners and everything else, he was the guy.
No, he was. There's no doubt about it. He was not only a great champion, but a great gentleman also. And our styles clashed, and so did our attitudes and our personality. And, you know, there's no doubt about it. I was not a popular champion at Wimbledon when I beat Ken in the finals there. They were expecting him to win his first Wimbledon, and he was 39 at the time. And for me to have walked off there winning that was it wasn't a popular victory in a lot of eyes, but it was pretty good for me.
Just four lines into The Outsider, the book, readers encounter this phrase, "screw 'em." I guess some of your fans will be surprised they had to wait four lines for that.
I was thinking about, you know, using that as a title, but I didn't think that would go over well. I say things like that because, you know, at the beginning, it wasn't all good. I came in at a time when things were changing in tennis, and to come in and to have my attitude, that's the way I had to play. But certainly along the way, we found something special, the fans and myself. We connected in a way that over the course of my career was an incredible feeling. They came in and won me more matches than probably I should have. You know, I owed them a lot, that's for sure.
You say in the book that if you could still play at a competitive level, you're as competitive now at 60 as you've ever been, and you'd be doing that. You'd be out there on the court. That's your nature. These days, what are you doing instead?
It's certainly difficult to find something to do to replace that. To be honest with you, I don't think I'll ever find it. To play on the major stages around the world and against the great players that I was able to play against at such a high level. So I don't look. I'm trying not to look anymore. And I was lucky to do what I did at such a high level, and maybe one thing is good enough.
Hall of Famer Jimmy Connors' book is The Outsider, a memoir published by HarperCollins, and he joined me from NPR West. Jimmy Connors, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
To read my review of Jimmy Connors' The Outsider, please go to onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word is from the athlete in this week's program who has the biggest heart. You'd feel that way, too, if for the rest of your life you were guaranteed endless bushels of carrots and lots of rest. Enjoy your retirement, Zippy. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.